Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. The Chapel Hill Playmakers Repertory Theater has a brand new boss, and his name is Joseph Hodge, who is the new producing artistic director. So who is he? And what is he going to do? And what difference will we be able to see in this upcoming season? And can he persuade us to purchase a ticket for any of the upcoming plays, or maybe even for a season ticket? And Joe Hodge, thanks. Thanks for coming to Chapel Hill to take this new position, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us today.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
First of all, what persuaded you to leave a very exciting career in the big theater and movie towns to come back to Chapel Hill?
I think coming back was a big part of it. I graduated from the professional actor training program here at UNC in 1988. I came here in the former artistic director's first year. 1985 was my first year, which was also David Hammond's first year. And I graduated here in 1988 and went to New York and worked in and out of New York for a time, worked in the regions, moved to Los Angeles, worked in the TV and film business, worked around the world quite a bit, and started a relationship back with Playmakers 3 seasons ago. I came back and assisted Mark Wing Davey on a production of King Lear, and then the following season I directed Not About Heroes, and just last season we closed the season with my adaptation of Cyrano, which I also directed.
So adaptation means you rewrote the play.
I did.
I just say, excuse me for interrupting, but people who are listening, those who are regular Playmakers attendees will recognize the three plays that you mentioned as three of the most memorable, for various reasons, most memorable, exciting productions that Playmakers did. So maybe you had a good time doing those.
Thank you for saying so. You know, I had a great time. And I moved, I guess I moved several years ago from being an actor to being a director. It's interesting how the trajectory has, you know, for a long time, just acting in the theater felt like all the questions I had to answer in the art form, I could explore and learn for myself by being an actor. And almost overnight, it started feeling very specialized. I felt like a punter on a football team, that I had one very specific job that I had to do, and it didn't feel that I had enough influence over the entirety of the event. So I started directing. And where you obviously have much more, for lack of a better term, authority over what one ends up seeing on the stage, which leads one to questions about who we make theater for and what theater is for and what sort of people you want to participate in the activity of it. And I started realizing that even as a director, you can only explore that question to a certain extent. And if you really want to explore this notion of what a theater community is and who a theater belongs to and who is allowed inside the building and who we take the building out to, the only way to really explore those questions is to lead a theater of your own. And a few years ago, that became something that I was looking to do. I got this grant from TCG, the Theater Communications Group, who funded me to, they basically said, we think you should be an artistic director. We think you should go around the country, find the best people in the business, and shadow them. Shadow the best artistic and executive directors about the non-artistic aspects of the job and learn how to do the stuff on the other side of the fence.
So that you're not taking on this, not having this ambition without knowing what it was like on the other side of the fence.
That's exactly right. I mean, there are there are administrative skills that one must have, and you have to learn them somehow. I knew an awful lot about making theater, and I learned an awful lot about how to run one by watching some of the great artistic leaders in this country and executive leaders in this country do their job. So, and then it just ended up being serendipitous that this job came up at a time when I was looking for just such a position, and I feel fortunate and indeed blessed to be back where I earned my union card all those years ago.
Well, just getting right to the meat of it, what's going to be different about the Playmakers as with having you here with that kind of background and that kind of commitment and the questions that you have about what theater ought to be doing?
Mm-hmm. I think Playmakers has such a strong, such a storied history and legacy, and there is much to admire about the way things have been done and the capable leadership that has come before. I think if one were to level a criticism, it might be this. Playmakers has a history of making 5 plays extremely well every year. I don't know if that's enough for the flagship theater in the state, in the Carolinas, in fact. I don't know if it's enough to only do, as hard as it is to do 5 plays well, I don't know if it's enough to only do 5 plays really well. I wonder if there doesn't have to be, I wonder if the obligation isn't for that building, that beautiful building, to not only be opened up for performances for those 5 shows over the course of the academic year. I wonder if that theater, that building, that flagship institution should be a cultural watering hole. I wonder if that should be a place whose doors are swung open for regional artists, national artists, international artists of various stripes, not only theater. I mean, I wonder if there aren't other responsibilities. I look at our audiences at PRC, and over the last few years I've gotten to see what they look like. I think our audiences are disproportionately white. I think they are disproportionately older against the general population as I see it. And I think we have to find ways to include those who don't come from a history of coming to the theater. And I think the short answer to how you get those people in the building is that you have to program for them. So we're starting a second stage series where we can do work that's maybe edgier. It's things that are more raw, things that really test the edges of what theater can be, things that are either thematically challenging or formally challenging the way that they're made by theater artists. And the first of those second stage series we'll see as the first Playmakers production of the year, in fact, this one-person show, which you may know about, I Am My Own Wife.
Well, tell us about that as an illustration of what edgier. I was thinking of avant-garde, but I guess avant-garde is a term that is no longer avant-garde.
Yeah.
But anyway, these are plays that you would be careful about going to. If you were a traditional theater person, you might get jarred a little bit if you go to.
Yeah, I mean, and I think this, yes. I think we want a second space, a second stage series where we can do work that is, I mean, maybe more challenging, to put it flatly. The first piece that's going in there has, in fact, won a Pulitzer Prize and a Tony Award. It's a play called I Am My Own Wife. It's a one-person play, a tour de force for an actor, in this case, John Felch, a magnificent actor, who plays all 35 roles to tell the story, the true story, of a German transvestite who survives both the Nazi and the communist reigns in Germany. And it's a stunning play. We took it out to the Stoneleaf Festival in Asheville, where it was the hit of the festival and was called Mesmerizing Theater, et cetera. And we thought this is a great way to inaugurate a second stage series.
Did you have that in mind when you organized the play or went to all the, I mean, it's difficult even with a one person play to get it ready. And did you have in mind that you might, or did they have in mind? I guess this was sort of the commitments were sort of made before you came, but
I think that it's a very good question. It was the commitments were made before I came. I think the intention all along was that it would go out, that we wanted to be represented at the Stoneleaf Festival. We thought it our responsibility to be represented there. The play was made for that. The production was made for that festival. I think the putting it into the second stage came later, but again, not by me. It was planned otherwise. But it seemed something that we should make this a series. We should find a way to do several things a year in our second space, which is the beautiful Black Box Theater, the Keenan Theater, which is same lobby as the Paul Green Theater, same lobby, same place. Right.
It's like it's like a multiplex.
It is. You've like got a multiplex.
You've got two stages,
exactly right.
In one. ticket booth.
That's
sort of
exactly
kind of,
right.
Is it? I guess I'm asking. This will not be going on at the same time as the regular series. But could you do that? Could you have two
plays?
Well,
you know,
going
in fact, what we're looking for in April, there's this fantastic spoken word hip hop theater company that I want to bring in the last week in April. And if we do bring them in, it will in fact overlap. We'll share that lobby during the time that The Illusion is playing, and we'll have two works
so
going
have
on
these,
in our place at the same time.
This crowd that you characterize, you know, my generation and older of the sort of the normal Playmakers crowd running in with a much running into the lobby for coffee and stuff.
And how great would
much,
that be?
Yeah, I think it would be great.
And how great would that be? I mean, to have a hip hop theater, people who are writing the only verse theater since the 1950s with T.S. Eliot and Christopher Fry, hip hop theater is where that is happening. Having that happen in the room next door to where we're doing an adaptation of a 17th century Corneille text, this just strikes me as a really good idea.
Yeah, and, maybe we could pay to watch the interaction of the two groups. Well, getting back to I Am My Own Wife, which is the first of the edgier theater, which would be in the different Kenan theater. I looked at a report from the Asheville newspaper about this book. It is a piece about a German lad who discovers he's really a girl trapped in a boy's body. Already controversy and tension. It's a one man slash woman show. With one actor. John Phelps playing lots of other actors, speaking in different languages, accents. The Asheville Citizen-Times reviewer said, but the true marvel is his quick switch from brash American soldier to cultivated European, from a New York writer to a lesbian aunt. He wears black peasant dress and head covering throughout, but his fine acting, his voice and movements is what it's all about. And the reviewer said it's mesmerizing theater, telling the story of a riveting personality who survives the reigns of Nazis and communists. It sounds, you know, both wonderful and weird. I mean,
yeah, well, I think it is both those things. And in the hands of a brilliant actor like John Felch, who in fact went through the program here 2 years before I did, spent 10 years at the Alley Theater with Greg Boyd. I did a production with John of Angels in America in the 90s with Tony Kushner, was very close to. He's one of the great actors, and in his hands it becomes something really extraordinary. And directed, of course, by our own Julie Fischel, who's one of our company members at
the
ARC.
Well, I'm talking to Joseph Hodge. Joe is the new, I can't keep the title straight. I call him the new boss of the Playmakers. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Joseph Hodge, who is the new producing artistic director of the Playmakers Repertory Theater. And Joe, thanks for telling us about some of the things that are going to be different already, although you've been quite forthcoming in giving credit for the brand new things for this year to mm-hmm. your staff and your predecessors in terms of the planning of it. I'd like for you, you've talked about the questions that you raised mainly about outreach and how the Playmakers might ought to be doing more to bring in a different audience and to go out more often. What are the what will keep you from doing this immediately?
Yeah, well, resources. We have to figure out how to reach. Well, let's put it this way. The vast majority of the and this isn't just PRC, mind you, this is the sector nationwide, and this is my observations on that TCG grant going around and my own experiences working in many of these theaters. Our audiences now in the American theater are largely people who come from a Western European culture of, they're the ancestors of people who come from a West European tradition of going to symphony, going to dance, going to opera, going to the theater. That's the majority of our audience today. The majority of our audience in the future are going to be people who are the descendants of Asians and Latinos and African Americans and Middle Easterners. This is going to be our audience in the future. And we haven't built a culture where we have taught the value and the importance of the arts to others, to ones who haven't had it handed down sort of generation to generation. And I think we're rapidly, I see the sector struggling with this altogether. We see diminishing audience bases. We haven't figured out either how to teach new generations, new people, why the work we're continuing to do is important. And we also haven't changed the kind of work that we do sufficiently to be attractive to young people and diverse people. And I think when you add to that equation that we are in an on-demand world, we want what we want when we want it, the idea of buying a subscription to the second Thursday, 9 months from now, is very hard for this generation to wrap their minds around. We have video on demand, we have TiVo, we have iPods, we have our news, our web page, we just get the information we want, our entertainment that we want, when we want it. And I am sure that I don't have all the answers to these questions, but these are the questions that we have to wrestle with to figure out how we get other people into the building. And I think most of our theaters operate now as if there is a huge existing need and that our only job is to get out and fulfill it. And I think we have to wrap our minds around the fact that there isn't a gigantic existing need, and we have to go create the need even as we create the product to fulfill the need.
To sell as well as manufacture.
I think that's right. I think we have to be able to make a convincing argument for why the arts are important to someone's life and go out and share that story.
It's interesting to me in trying to put myself in your shoes that one of the challenges is to change but not to lose the solid base of support that you got from the traditional theater goer, because sure as you make any change, even the lighting or the color of the backdrop, folks who are used to this and who provide support, you'll get a drop off of support from them if you change too rapidly or change too dramatically. So
we're talking about in addition to, not in exchange for or instead of. And I think that's why the Second Stage series became so important to me, because I thought, well, there's no way. I mean, this theater has a 31-year compact with its audience. There is no way to go and say, well, I am no longer interested in making these kinds of plays. And, of course, that's not at all true either. I mean, I like the plays that Playmakers makes. I think we need to be doing more. So how do we do more? I think we create a second stage series where we bring, we invite our current audience to see things that are braver. We bring in younger people who are interested in things that are braver. When that becomes a packed event and we know that we can migrate that kind of work to our main stage, then we will. I think there's a way to do it. I just think it's not about throwing out one group in favor of another. It's about casting a wider net. It's about being more of a sense of invitation. I mean, the barrier to entry at PRC is not about the cost of tickets. Students literally come see our work for the price of a movie ticket. That is not the barrier to entry. It's not the money. It's not like going to the opera. The barrier to entry has to do with convincing people that we're making something that has something to do with their lives, that they will see themselves in our work. And we have to make sure that our programming reflects a more diverse population.
Joseph Hodge, let's take a quick break and then come back and talk about the upcoming regular season. Joseph Hodge, the producing artistic director of the Playmakers, and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Joseph Hodge, who is the producing artistic director of the Playmakers. And Joe, your you're selling me the second stage series, which I'm real excited about, and we'll maybe have time to talk a little bit more about that. But basically, those of us who are Playmakers regulars want to know what you've got in store for us this year. And there will be the traditional five-part series. You don't have any notes in front of you. Maybe I can, but you can probably you probably got this memorized.
I know, I've got it. I'm very, very excited about this slate of plays. We start with the Steve Martin adaptation of a Carl Sternheim play called The Underpants, which is a fall down funny farce. It's really, really, it's hysterical and it's very smart. And we have it in the hands of the three-time Tony Award-winning director Gene Sachs, who directed Front Page, which was a hit for PRC last season. He's coming back to direct The Underpants, and that's so we're getting out.
It
of
It sounds a little racy,
play.
But is that just tricky?
That's no, you know, it's the story. It's the story of a young woman in Germany very long ago, who is out to watch the Kaiser's parade, who gets up on her tiptoes and her bloomers fall down around her ankles, which causes her to be a celebrity for a time. And she has this series of suitors who come to rent from her husband's place in order to get close to her while her celebrity is on the rise. And it's hysterical. It's a door-slamming farce. And I think kind of explores in a little bit this question of celebrity and why one becomes attractive for a time and for what reasons. And in Gene Sachs, very, very, I mean, he's one of the legends, of course, and he won a Tony for Brighton Beach Memoirs, and he's associated with many of the Neil Simon plays. So that's our first play.
Let me just ask you about that. And this is... for an inside look at, with this play, which will open in October, would that be about right?
That's right.
And how far along is it? You've got your director. You've already cast it. Is it in rehearsals yet? What? How do you schedule all of this?
No, it starts rehearsal the end of September. We rehearse for each show for 4.5 weeks. Tech, where we go in with
the no way I can try out for any part, though. It's already cast.
You know, I think Underpants might be locked up, DG, but we'll find something for you. But, you know, designers and directors are put to those. We've started putting those together.
So the set designers are at work. What would they be doing at this two or three months beforehand?
Right now, our set designer, who's also our costume designer, Marion Williams, it takes a train for 2.5 hours from New York City to Gene's house out in East Hampton, and has design meetings with him, and they talk a lot and research a lot, and she draws and they talk and she sketches and they talk, and eventually she'll create a model which Gene will look at, which our people at PRC will look at, and make sure it's something we can build, make sure we can build it for the budget that we say, make sure it works for sight lines in our space. As you know, we have the deep thrust stage, which makes the set design a particular challenge. And these things happen months in advance. Most of the designers and directors were put together before I began, and that was on July 1st. So there's a very long timeline in terms of getting that stuff out in advance of actual rehearsals.
Who makes the selections for the players, for the people who are going to be actors and actresses in this? Is this the director's responsibility, or is there an intersecting role, a cooperative role between people on your staff, you and the director?
It's cooperative. It is it's the director's final call. Usually what happens is we will have a budget for, if let's say there's a cast of 8 people, we might say we're going to have 3 out-of-town guests for this show. And typically the director is going to have a great deal of autonomy in selecting who those 3 people are. We say this is what we have to pay them, this is what the package is for those people to come, but it's up to the director to identify. We set up casting sessions. As the producing artistic director, I'd be in the room for New York castings as we identify who people are. But of course, we know here our people and their skills best, and we position them to various directors saying, we think so-and-so would be excellent here. We look for graduate students to have significant opportunities in Playmakers shows, and we try to have those directors come down here to take a look at them, or allow them or ask them to allow us to identify roles that we could put them in so that they can have significant.
So that there would be some kind of trust level. I remember when you were talking about directing the adaptation of Cyrano that you did, that when you agreed to come, you had in mind an actor.
Yeah.
For Cyrano.
Yeah. Well, there are certain roles for certain directors. I mean, we as directors, we all have our opinions. And, you know, there are certain things that are just, well,
I was just saying Ray Dooley.
Right. Well, right. I mean, there are things that are deal breakers. I mean, you just say, well, if we're doing Cyrano, I have Ray. I mean, if Ray's not going to do it, why would we do that play? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are certain plays you do for certain actors. I don't think you decide you're going to do Hamlet and then go look and see if you find somebody who can play it. You do it because you have an actor in mind.
Now, Underpants is not one of those plays.
Underpants is not one of those plays.
That you look, I mean, I'm just trying to think as you described the woman whose bloomers fall down. Mm-hmm. I don't know the play, but I'm just guessing that she would have to be quite a personality.
I think so. I think we're still in the process of finalizing the cast for that, so I can't.
Well, now you
really
said it was closed. I wouldn't be eligible for that. You don't think I would fit that role? Probably.
But I think it's going to be a very good mix of our graduate students, our company members, our community professionals.
Let me ask you this about Underpants, and then we'll talk about we want to get through the whole season.
Sure,
and if
sure.
I keep interrupting you, we won't do that. But the sort of suggested raciness of this comedy raises the question – again, with respect to your typical playmaker's audience that is conditioned to want excellence and traditional plays, that when you go off into a funny, racy situation, you're always going to have people in that audience who say, that's a little bit too racy for us on that.
Yeah.
Or maybe in this, maybe in Chapel Hill, that doesn't.
Yeah.
You have to worry about that a little bit?
Well, maybe a little bit. I mean, you know, the nice thing about this job and one of the great things about leading this particular theater is it's a theater that has it's a smart audience. I mean, it's on a university campus. You have a really, really sophisticated audience. I really think a season is about balance. I can't program a season that where every I can anticipate that every play will please everybody. I mean, we're not interested in being the McDonald's of theater where, you know, everybody can find something to eat, but none of it is particularly good.
Quarter pounder won't be there every night. You're going to have a whole different table, and it might have some food on it that in your favorite.
We have to be willing. I mean, I think we have to be willing as the people who make the work. And I think we have to be willing as audiences who come see the work. You know, we invest in the life of a theater. We come for a season knowing that there will be things in there that are tremendously fulfilling, that there will be some things that we find challenging and even on occasion things that we just don't particularly care for. But that's what it is to belong to a theater. And, of course, not everybody has the same opinion. There's a play like The Underpants, which isn't particularly racy, but is very, very funny. And if people like comedies, it's a great one in the hands of one of our directors with great comic gifts. If one likes a good comedy smartly made, this is a show for them. If one doesn't like comedies, you know, there's no sense trying to make The Underpants look like a Chekhov play. It's not. It is itself. And we hope that people who want a different kind of experience is going to find something very satisfying for themselves through the course of
That's interesting. I mean, some of the complaints in the past years have been that Playmakers is too serious and challenging and deep. And so maybe it'll be fun to hear a complaint after Underpants in which somebody said, well, this was very entertaining, but it didn't speak to my life's experience.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
It didn't.
And this is the equation. I mean, this is what happens all the time. You're constantly erring one way or the other. I think in the end, a lot of my job is a curatorial one. You know, it's about balance. It's about satisfying the artists who work in that building, the university people who are many of our biggest supporters, and many of our doing intellectual work. But that isn't altogether academic, doing artistic work that isn't altogether indulgent. I mean, these are the challenges. If you make your work only for the artist, then it can be too navel-gazing and indulgent. If you make it only for the academics, it's too from the neck up. If you make it to make as much money as you possibly can, then your work is way too commercial. But if you think of if you think of these tensions as sort of the guy wires that hold up the walls of this building, then the space inside that is where we can work. These tensions are good. These are things that are healthy. And I think if one doesn't push in all one's chips with any of these particular camps, well, then you're doing well, I think. So you find a season that has balance. We have the underpants opening the season. And then we have...
Let's take a break.
Yes.
And then we'll come back, and I promise you, I'm just going to let you tell us about the rest of the upcoming Playmakers season, and we'll hear about that from Joseph Hodge, the new producing artistic director. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Joseph Hodge, the new producing artistic director of the Playmakers Repertory Theater here in Chapel Hill. And Joseph, I've gotten so excited about the few things that I've let you talk about that if I don't just be quiet and let you tell us about the rest of the upcoming regular Playmakers season after the opener, the comedy Underpants. What happens
next? Well, after the Underpants, we have Tuesdays with Maury, which is, of course, based on the best-selling book by Mitch Albom. And Mitch Albom, in fact, has done the adaptation with another playwright called Jeffrey Hatcher. And it's the story of I expect almost everybody listening is going to know the story. But it's a young man who is a sports writer, very ambitious, who has perhaps forgotten about what is most important in a life. And his former college professor, who is suffering from a debilitating disease, who he comes to meet every Tuesday to learn once again what are the things that matter most. And it's a relationship play. It's a poignant and beautiful look and reminder about the things that matter most.
A lot of people, as you pointed out, will have read this book, and is the many of us want to go see the movie after we've read the book. We want to see how it's going to be different. Mm-hmm. But is this play, do you think, designed for the new person who's not read the book, or is it for the...
I think that's a very good question. I think it is so terrifically faithful to the book that if you haven't read the book, you'll understand the book by seeing the play. And if you have read the book, you'll see how well
just
taken care of it is in this play. Mm-hmm. A richer experience by seeing it done in dialogue, in a theatrical set, with two. And Joan, our own Joan Darling, is directing that. And she's looking at some world-class actors to come in to play Maury. So we should watch out for that. I think it's going to be a really impressive production.
In a production like this, is the where the concentration is on the actors and the conversation, the costume and set design, while very critical, is not the enormous challenge, is it?
There are particular challenges, but I think it doesn't have a sense of pageantry. I mean, it's absolutely right. It's a relationship play. It's about those two people. But, of course, McKay Coble is doing the set and costumes, and she did Cyrano and Not About Heroes for Me, and she's the best of the best. So there's no chance that it isn't something beautiful and amazing. I mean, I just think there's just no chance that that won't happen. So it'll be very interesting to see how she and Joan work together to put together the landscape for this play.
Well, now I have to push you along.
Yes.
And what comes after that?
So after that is Stones in His Pockets, which will be directed by John Felch. It's two actors who play 65 roles of an entire rural Irish village. And it is the story of these two extras on a Hollywood movie that is shooting in rural Ireland. And it is a very funny and also very acute and sometimes moving look at Hollywood's global reach and how that often isn't a very good thing, and what it does to people's dreams and what it does to people's culture. So that's happening there. After that is perhaps the play that I'm most excited about in our season is the adaptation of Toni Morrison's novel, The Bluest Eye. It's this brilliant adaptation done by Lydia Diamond, which is thunderous and brilliantly theatrical, and the Tony Award winner Trezana Beverly will be directing that for us. And it's
just again to put this in perspective, you Playmakers there has an ongoing relationship with Trezana Beverly.
We do indeed,
and she's an award-winning person on the on the New York, you know, in the New York stage.
That's right. No, she's someone.
But she loves Chapel Hill.
Yeah,
she even talks about going to church in Chapel Hill.
You know, with Gene Sachs, and I mean, we for reasons having to do with the beauty of this town, for reasons having to do with the excellence and sophistication of the work PRC makes, we can attract those with significant national reputations for their work. In some ways, I feel Playmakers is the best kept secret in the Triangle, that we're known better for those in the trade nationally than we're even known locally or regionally, which I find interesting and that we must correct immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I think in the Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye presents a wonderful opportunity, of course, for outreach, not just in trying to broaden the audience, but in my judgment, there are many of us who grew up taking English and American literature where Langston Hughes was the only black author we ever heard of.
Yes.
And some of us still hadn't gotten around to reading some of the magnificent work of contemporary African-American authors, and I shouldn't say this, but particularly female authors like Toni Morrison. And this provides, like the other play, Afternoons with Maury, or Tuesdays with Maury, an opportunity. If you hadn't read the book, you can come and sort of get the feel of it in a richer way.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think you put it. I think you put it beautifully. I mean, the fact that Toni Morrison is represented in this way, in a stage production, and we're very proud that we have one of the very first regional productions of this play. We have the regional premiere of it. I think there's only been one or two other productions nationally. We have one of the very first, and we're very excited. And we're in talks with Toni Morrison. We're in discussion trying to persuade her to come down for a visit while we're in
well,
the
when that
the
news comes
here.
Up, let WCHL.
Yes,
that will be big news.
We will indeed. We're looking to put together a lecture series, which is part of our dreams going forward. But I'll keep going. So after The Bluest Eye, we close the season with Corneille's The Illusion, which is adapted by Tony Kushner, who, of course, wrote Angels in America.
What does Tony Kushner bring as an adapter? And you do this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. so you know the challenges, mm-hmm. but also the awesome responsibility that an adapter has. Why do you trust Tony Kushner to do the adaptation?
Well, I would trust Tony Kushner to run this country. I think he is the smartest person in the American theater. I really do. I literally believe that. And I also think Angels in America is perhaps the great. Those two plays are perhaps the great plays of my generation.
Wow.
I think he's one of the most important.
Who's going to want to see this play?
Who's going to want to see this play? I think it's I think anybody who loves Cyrano, I'm directing it. I think anybody who liked Cyrano will like The Illusion, in that it's witty, it's lyrical, it's a story of a man towards the end of his life who goes and finds this sorcerer, this magician, to help him find his son, who he's been long estranged from, and which makes it sound perhaps more heavy than it's a lot of it is very witty and smart and fast, but it's also lyrical and
not
beautiful.
The pageantry of Cyrano, though, not the sword fights.
It has a sense of, it has a true sense, it is perhaps the most, well, no, I'll take that back, I can't say that, but it is a very theatrical play. It does have a sense of the pageantry, a sense of magic to it. So if I had to define it in such a way of who might like it, I would think people who came to Cyrano would like to see.
If you like Cyrano, you'll like this.
I think so.
And again, this all intersects because Joseph Hodge, who directed and adapted Cyrano, will be directing The Illusion, which has been adapted by Tony Kushner. And so it all intersects back, because now you're the boss and you won't have to negotiate with the producing artistic director about this one. You will be in total charge of this.
I don't even know who I'll argue with.
Well, I promise you I won't try out for any parts.
Oh, that's a shame. I had something for you in The Illusion.
Joseph Hodge, the new producing artistic director of the Playmakers, has been giving us a little bit of insight into the Playmakers and to the upcoming season. We hope that we'll be able to persuade him to come back, visit with us more as the season gets started.
Thank you so much, DG. It's been great to be here.
And in the meantime, Joe, thanks so much for sharing your busy life with us. And thanks all y'all for listening. I'll be back same time tomorrow.